Merci.
Well, I am honored to be here tonight, and I'm certainly honored that you cared enough about the life and legacy of the late, great Alvin Barkley to give up your evening to come down and hear a few stories told and perhaps share a few stories and remembrances of your own tonight. As you see, there's a number of photographs around the room for you to go down memory lane, remembering Barkley and all that he accomplished, and see his family. I certainly want to thank his family for opening up their memories and their scrapbooks to me so that we could have these this memorabilia present for you tonight. Certainly want to thank my staff for their efforts, Carol Ulrich, my staff attorney, and Debbie Staples, my secretary, for their efforts in helping me prepare for tonight's program, and also the staff at Zebra Graphics. I know that there are a number of political scientists and historians in the room tonight, so the pressure is on. But if I misstate anything tonight or you have anything to add, I certainly hope time will allow us to call on you for your wisdom and your insight. I know that if I name all of them, if I try to name anyone, I'll forget someone, but there are a number here that are particularly close to me in regard to our study of Barkley, and I'd like to mention them by name. Dr. John Robertson, Jack Johnston, Bill Bartleman has been a great help, also Barry Craig. Gerald Watkins is here tonight, professor of political science at the local community college, and many others. Also want to thank my fiance, Dr. Carolyn Watson, who is with us tonight, for her support and help in the past few weeks in preparing my comments tonight. Certainly want to thank Bobby Wrinkle for her kind invitation to speak tonight on one of my favorite subjects, the late U.S. Vice President Alvin W. Barkley, affectionately known to all of us as the Veep. I have known Bobby and her husband, local attorney David Wrinkle, for many years, and in fact formerly served with David as an assistant McCracken County attorney under the Honorable Dan Bowes, who now serves as the local Commonwealth attorney. I'd like to thank both Bobby and David for their friendship to me and for their faithful and devoted service to our community. And I hope my comments tonight will live up to the expectations arising from Bobby's fine introduction and will in some small way contribute to our community's understanding and appreciation for Barkley, one of our region's most popular and successful favorite sons. Since I was a child growing up on Paducah Southside and attending its public schools at D.T. Cooper Elementary, Jaton Junior High, and Paducah Tillman High School, I heard my elders speak respectfully of a man they affectionately and reverently called the Veep. This is the term which I later learned was coined by one of Barkley's grandchildren, then 10-year-old Steve Truitt, after he was elected as vice president. Seems that young Steve thought that it was a mouthful to say vice president, and so he put the V and the P together and said, why don't we slap a couple of E's in between them and we'll just call it Veep. Well, Barkley thought that was pretty humorous, and he shared that with some media that week, and the term caught on. In fact, he was quite pleased later when dictionaries came out and included Veep as a new word in the American, the English language. That's where the Veep came from. Later, as a college student majoring in political science and communications, my professors, upon learning I was from Paducah, demanded that I become conversant about Barkley. To that end, I spent one college winter term researching and writing a paper about Alvin Barkley. At that time, I was blessed to have been able to interview his late son, David Bud Barkley, while visiting him at the family's former home called Angles, which is located here in Paducah. Over time, I've been able to interview several other members of the Barkley family, and I'm thankful to them for extending to me their friendship and their trust. We in Western Kentucky are surrounded by reminders of Barkley's legacy. Barkley Airport, Barkley Dam, Albin Barkley Drive, and anything and anyone who knows anything about how we got the USEC plant will recall how Barkley brought that to our community as well. We drive down the streets of our community and we see Barkley's home, Angles. We see Barkley's church, Broadway United Methodist Church. Barkley's school, the now defunct Marvin College over in Clinton. And the location of Barkley's law office is marked on Broadway by a historical marker as well. Various historical plaques and portraits hanging in the McCracken County Courthouse where he practiced law announce his accomplishments. He served as judge in that courthouse as well as prosecuting attorney. But still, many of our current citizens, and particularly our young people, have no idea who America's 35th vice president was in American and world history. Generally, they have no idea about his humble beginnings, his hard work and high visions for society, his gifted oratory, and his leadership skills. More specifically, they have no understanding of his honorable representation of the people of this area and his vast contributions to our quality of life in far western Kentucky, our nation, and the world. Now, folks, this year marks a very important occasion. You see, November 24th, 2012 will mark the 135th anniversary of Barkley's humble birth in his grandfather's log cabin in the country crossroads of Wheel, a small community located between Lowe's and Fancy Farm in Graves County. As a proud native of far western Kentucky and as an amateur historian and longtime admirer of Barkley and his public service, I'm hopeful that our local schools, churches, libraries, governments, and other agencies will find ways this year to celebrate his life and legacy. And to that end, and to do my part, at this time I'd like to call Bobby Wrinkle of the library forward once more. And I'd like to present her with a framed portrait of Barkley, which includes information highlighting his life and his contributions. And I'm hopeful that you'll find an appropriate place here at the library to hang this so all of our citizens, but particularly our young people, can look upon Barkley's face, see his accomplishments, and dream dreams for their own lives.
Oh, thank you so much. This will go well in our local family history. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, and God bless you. Likewise, tonight I'd like to announce that I will be donating similar framed portraits of Barkley to all of our schools, public and private, located here in Paducah and McCracken County, for that same purpose. I've already done so for the schools and public agencies in Graves County, Barkley's place of birth, and will be doing the same for Hickman County, where Barkley obtained his early education. I encourage others to take up this cause. Please help me preserve the memory of Barkley in the minds, hearts, and spirits of our youth. As I said, in doing so, perhaps we can inspire others to rise from similar humble beginnings to reach the heights of public leadership and service. The youth of today will be the leaders of tomorrow, and it's the duty of those of us who go before them to ensure they are prepared to face the challenges and opportunities that await them. Now, at this time, I'd also like to recognize another very prominent guest. Barkley was very proud of his family and his heritage. In fact, I think I have yes, there we go. There's the Veep. He's holding two young people. Well, one of those young people grew up. Actually, both of them did. One of them could be with us tonight. And I'd like for Albin Barkley, the Veep's grandson, if he would, please come forward, and I'd like to present him with a similar portrait to hang in his home or to do with as he wishes. There you go, Albin. You want to say something right quick to this crowd, sir?
Actually, that wasn't part of the deal, but but I would like to say one thing, and that is I am greatly appreciative of Shay Nickel taking the opportunity and putting out the effort to remember my grandfather. He does a much better job than I do, and I don't think that appreciation is shown in the appropriate way a lot of times, but I want to say today that I greatly appreciate it. Thank you,
sir.
Shay.
God bless you. Thank you, sir.
Albin's sister, Dottie, couldn't be with us tonight, but Albin, I have another framed portrait for her. If you and Pat would make sure that she receives that and tell her how much we appreciate her and all that she does.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Now then, if anyone here in this room would like a similar portrait to hang in your home, your school, or your house, when you leave tonight at the back table, there'll be prints available free of charge to anyone who would like to take one. Now, I happen to get mine framed at Hobby Lobby, but there's a number of great frame shops here in Paducah, and I hope you'll take this, have it appropriately framed, and hang it in a place of honor where it can be seen and appreciated. They'll be out in the back as you leave tonight. Also, anyone in the television listening audience, if you don't like one of these prints, as long as they last, you can contact my office and I'll be proud to give you one for the same purpose. Now, I'm going to try to provide you with a little bit of biographical background regarding Barclay's life. And these statistical facts about Barclay will provide a sketch of his life. And as I go along, I'll hope to share a few stories about him that will add a little bit of color. Barclay, as I said earlier, was born on November 24th, 1877, in the small community of Wheel, located between Lowe's and Fancy Farm in Graves County. He shares his birthday with that of U.S. President Zachary Taylor, born in 1784, who just happened to have grown up in Louisville, Kentucky. The log cabin in which Barclay was born was located on a farm belonging to his paternal grandparents, Albin Graham Barclay and Amanda Louise Barclay. And I'm not great at technology, but I'm going to try to show you a few pictures tonight that I appreciate the family sharing with me. This is a picture of Albin Barclay, the Veep's grandfather, working his field over in Graves County on their farm. Years later, he went with his son, Bud, back to the home place, and he's standing by a tree there that he remembers his grandfather planting along the fence line. That's not the original Barclay home. Their home was a two-story log cabin. There he is standing by an outbuilding that was built by his family. It's got siding on it now, but the original structure was underneath there. That building is gone now as well. And there he is standing beside the tree. Now, does anyone in here notice anything unusual about Barclay in this picture? Well, he's got a little fur underneath his nose. This was the one time in his life that he grew a mustache. And he once said that every man should try it one time at least. And this was his one time. It didn't last long, but they'd just come out of a long and bitter campaign reminiscent of a recent one that we've had in modern times, where the battle cry of the other side was, we want change, change, change. So when the media asked Barclay why he grew this mustache, he said, well, the other side was wanting change, and I aimed to give it to him. So he did. But it didn't last long. Isn't that a fine-looking young man? That's Barclay about the time he graduated from Marvin College. And you see the medal on his vest? He was an outstanding orator and debater So much so that two of his teachers predicted that he would become president of the United States. And he took that to heart. Teachers have a huge impact on the children that the Lord brings in front of them. And so we should all be thankful for teachers. I've got two good ones in my family. Actually, my brother now as well. But Barclay took it to heart. We'll get back to that. Barclay was married. Well, let me talk about this first of all. Let me say this about his father. Barclay's father was a farmer, a tenant farmer. They were very religious Presbyterians, hardworking, and they raised tobacco. And so Barclay always had a warm spot in his heart for farmers, and he was closely identified with them all during his political career. Now, what's happened, I know, being a politician of some sort, I know what's happened here. Barclay has probably been driving down the country road, and he's seen a farmer out in the field working. And so, seeing him working, Barclay figured he'd go work too. So he went over to speak to this farmer and had his picture taken with him and did a little politicking at the same time. Probably impressed the farmer with all of his knowledge about farming, because as a young man, he farmed alongside his father. Dapper young fellow, wasn't he? Very good looking fella. And I like this picture here. Knickers. I'm glad we don't wear them anymore, but I do like that hat he's got on. But he was certainly a man of the people. Now, Barclay was married to Dorothy Brower in 1903. She was the consummate political wife and an efficient, loving, and nurturing mother. She also traveled extensively with Barclay, as we'll see later. The Barclays had three children. They had David, who they called Bud, Marion, who they called Sis. There's another picture of the young couple. There she is traveling with him. Then there they are in older life. And there's the family. As I said, Bud, Sis, and then they had Wawi. Her Christian name was Laura Louise. She grew up to marry a nephew of General Douglas MacArthur. In later years, Dorothy suffered from a heart condition, and Alban Barclay and Dorothy donated money to the University of Louisville School of Medicine to find treatment for heart disease. I know my fiance will appreciate that, being a graduate of the U of L Medical School. But they gave back to their communities, which all public servants do. There they are out on a picnic. They were doting parents, loved their children. Now, just like all parents, you want to take your family on a trip. Here's Barclay with his three children standing in front of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, giving their children an early education. There they are. That's the Barclays watching protectively their daughter take some pictures at Niagara Falls on another excursion. Now, I like this next series of pictures I'm going to share with you. That's one of the cars Barclay was so proud to own. And you'll see that's him sitting in the front. And I don't know if it's for her own protection or not, but Mrs. Barclay is sitting in the back. They're getting ready to take off for a grand vacation. Proud papa there. Well, what always happens, men, when we go on vacations with our families? We have flat tires. Well, the vice president was not too good to get out and change his own tire. And there he is, his family watching him. Now, he didn't care for this next picture too much. But it as he saw the humor in it, he came around to it. Not the best picture, perhaps, but caught him in the act of changing that tire. He was proud of his family, like I said. He's particularly proud of his son David, who was with the military, and this picture appeared across the nation in magazines, and that's proud papa there with his son, and that's their two dogs down there in the bottom, and you can see that they're proud too. There's the vice president with Bud, and Albin, is that you there, Holy? That's Dottie. That's three generations of Barclays there. Mighty good picture. Now, I mentioned that Albin was married to Dorothy, and she was not just a stay-home mother, although she was a fine mother. She got out on the campaign trail with him and pitched in. Here she is at a Democratic Women's fundraiser, and she's got her dollar bill that she's contributing to some fund or cause there. Someone said, I wonder what that dollar bill would be worth in today's economy. But anyway, she's doing her part there. And here she is with the congressional women. This is during World War I. And if you look carefully, she is she's over there to the far right. And I think I can do better. Well, I didn't get a close-up of it, but basically she's sitting right over here. And there, all the congressional wives are doing their part to support the doughboys in World War I. Here she is christening a boat representing her husband. Uh-oh. Hit the button. Now what do I do? Did you hit it? There, it's gone. Okay. Now, sometimes if you look at her expression on this in this carriage, I don't know if she's just really happy to be there or not. But she's. but he looks like he's having a grand old time. And this is on one of their excursions overseas. As I said, they traveled a lot. His responsibilities in Congress, on his committees, caused him to travel extensively. He also served on a lot of investigative committees as well. This is the young Barclay standing in front of the family's first home on 200 Fountain Avenue. There's his wife pushing a young'un. And like I said, just like that flat tire, they had problems too, just like the rest of us. Man of the people. There you go. That's an early flood. That's a 19. What is that, Alvin? The 1907 flood or 13? 13. 1913 flood came right up to lapped at the front doors of their house, and that's the family in the front yard and some of the kids in the boat. Now, I mentioned angles earlier, and you know what a fine house that is here in Paducah. Beautiful. Well. This was the house when the Barclays bought it. So you can see they did some extensive renovating and landscaping when they bought that house. But Barclay had driven by that house many years and admired it, and was later in life to purchase it. And there he is as a young representative. Now, let me get back to my notes and share a little bit more information with you. As I said, he married Dorothy. They had a long and happy marriage together. Later in life, after Dorothy's death, he married Elizabeth Jane Rucker Hadley Barker 2 years after Dorothy's death. And after a four-month courtship, they were married on November 18th, 1949, right before his birthday. Now, Barclay's paternal grandmother served as midwife to his birth and stimulated his early political interests, particularly with stories of his kinfolk who were also involved in politics. You see, Barclay was a distant cousin of Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, who won the Democratic Party's nomination for president after Barclay withdrew. Stevenson later served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Now, Stevenson's grandfather, or Cousin Adlai, as Barclay called him, Well, Stevenson's grandfather was also named Adlai Stevenson, and he served as an Illinois congressman, and he also went on to serve as the 23rd U.S. Vice President in the administration of Grover Cleveland, another Democrat, from 1893 to 1897. Interestingly, years later, the elder Stevenson campaigned against his former boss, Cleveland, when he joined the populist ticket of William Jennings Bryan and again sought to become vice president in the 1990 election. Of course, we know they were not successful. So the Barclays and the Stevensons are descended from a common ancestor from Rowan County, North Carolina, of Scotch-Irish descent and a Presbyterian. Barclay's parents, John Wilson Barclay and Electra Eliza Smith Barclay, were, as I said earlier, deeply religious tenant tobacco farmers and members of the Presbyterian Church as well. Barclay's political views were shaped in large part by his impoverished upbringing, his training to work hard, and his religious faith. In addition to his grandmother's prodding regarding the family's record of public service, Barclay's father was quite active in the local association of farmers fighting for their interest. So it would be no surprise that the Veep became a friend to farmers. Now, Barclay would later break with the family's tradition of belonging to the Presbyterian Church when he joined the Methodist Church. And this may have been due to the influence of his early education at the now-defunct Marvin College, which was located over in Hickman County. You see, Marvin College was a Methodist school. At Marvin College, Barclay excelled in oratory and debate and was greatly influenced by his teachers to pursue a career in law. Now, the Methodists have long emphasized living out the Great Commandment, which basically is love God and serve others. And the ministry of public service resonated with Barclay. The Methodists also like to sing, and they've been sometimes called shouting Methodists. Well, Barclay adopted the shouting part in his oratory on occasion, and also enjoyed a good song. Barclay was too poor to afford tuition at Marvin College and was given a full-time custodial position to help defray the cost. Later in life, he often used self-depreciating humor to set folks at ease, and he would allude to the various historical markers all around the country, which would say things like, Washington slept here, or Lincoln slept here. And then he would recall his days as a full-time custodian at Marvin College, and he'd say that the school and community leaders should erect a sign there stating, Barclay swept here. Well, once he became vice president, they did. If you go over there, you can still see the marker. The school is gone, but the marker is there. After graduating from Marvin College, Barclay wanted to continue his education at Emory College in Oxford, Georgia. And he tried to raise funds to pay his tuition and board by becoming a traveling salesman of cooking pots. Well, the good news was that Barclay was a very convincing salesperson and sold many cooking pots to numerous area farm families. The bad news was that the cooking pots proved defective and cracked when you cooked with them. Well, being a person of integrity, Barclay reimbursed every person who had purchased the defective cooking pots from him. The experience left him, as they would say, pert nigh broke and unable to pay his tuition to attend Emory as he dreamed. But it won for him a reputation of being a man of integrity and honor, something that would later benefit him when he entered public life. The people of McCracken County remembered his efforts when he first ran for office and elected him in his first race. Well, a local judge hearing of Barclay's plight, agreed to finance his studies by allowing him to borrow $200. So Barclay got to go to Emory after all. He was there for a year. But his poor finances prevented him from returning to Emory College, and so he took a job teaching at Marvin College. Well, he didn't take to teaching too much. Part of the reason was he was so young, and all of his friends were now his students. So he wasn't a very good disciplinarian, and so his tenure as a teacher was not long. Plus, he really had no affinity for teaching. His dream was to become a lawyer and to enter public service. So Barclay quit and relocated to Paducah, where his parents had relocated. In fact, his father had given up farming by that time and was working in a cotton mill. Barclay was able to get a job as a clerk for Paducah attorney Charles K. Wheeler. Now, that's another name our youth should remember, because attorney Wheeler was also a member of Congress. He was gone a lot. Barclay didn't see him very often. One time he came back unexpectedly and caught Barclay in the law library reading a book by Dickens, and said, "Son, you'll never become an attorney without reading the law books." And Barclay quickly explained to him that he was just taking a break and enjoying some light reading before returning to the heavier, the weightier law books. But he did a good job for Congressman Wheeler. Unfortunately, Congressman Wheeler didn't pay him too much, and he later described these years as quite a struggle. One of the requirements of the job for Attorney Wheeler was that Barclay learned to take shorthand notes. This fact would have significance later when Barclay met President Wilson as a freshman representative. Barclay was able to improve his financial condition by taking a similar job a short time later with another law firm, which included former Congressman John K. Hendrick and former Judge William Sutton Bishop. Now, why should we raise an eyebrow and notice that he worked for Judge Bishop? Well, Judge Priest, thank you. Yes, you read Irving Cobb, obviously. Irving S. Cobb, who became quite a good friend of Barclay's, wrote a number of novels, many of them that included Judge Priest, a local judge, fictional judge, that was known for his wit, his wisdom, and being a bit absent-minded. Well, it should be no surprise to you that that's exactly how Barclay described Judge Bishop. Absent-minded, but with a keen legal mind. And so Barclay had some great mentors in his early legal career. Barclay later would quip that Cobb had reduced Judge Bishop from a bishop to merely a priest. But as I said earlier, Cobb and Barclay became fast friends, and later when Barclay had attained some stature in Washington, Cobb wrote articles saying, "We ought to make this man president." So they were good friends. After 2 years of reading for the bar, Barclay was admitted to the law practice in 1901. To make ends meet and to save a little, he continued to serve as a court reporter while working as an attorney. In time, he had saved enough money to attend additional law classes at the University of Virginia. He recalled going out every Saturday to visit the home of Thomas Jefferson and how those experiences inspired him for public service and intellectual inquiry. When Barclay returned to Paducah, he quickly entered into the political scene, and his first elective office was that of McCracken County Attorney. And he was said to have campaigned initially on an old one-eyed mule. This began a long and successful journey that took him from serving as McCracken County Attorney to the second highest political office in the land. His offices included McCracken County Attorney from 1901 to 1905, McCracken County Court Judge 1905 to 1909, the U.S. House of Representatives for the 1st District of Kentucky, 1913 to 1927, and I can't recall if I said it or not, but you know who he beat in one of those races to become your representative? His former mentor, Judge Bishop. He also served in the U.S. Senate from 1927 through 1949, and again from 1995 through 1996. Served as the U.S. Senate Minority Leader from 1947 through 1949, U.S. Senate Majority Leader from 1947 to 1949, and as your 35th U.S. Vice President from 1949 through 1953. A few years ago, we had a celebration to mark his inauguration as Vice President, and I want to tell you that one of our biggest supporters at that time was Senator Mitch McConnell. I mentioned several other names tonight of amateur historians. Well, Senator McConnell is not an amateur historian. He is well-versed in the history of the Congress, particularly the Senate, and American history. And I was very pleased when I could present him with one of these Barclay prints as well. Very interesting man, and both he and Barclay, obviously, have served in the same positions and have represented Kentucky well. Well, let's catch up a little bit. There's Barclay as a young representative in Washington. Looks very astute there, doesn't he? Now, what does a freshman congressman do when you get to Washington? When you go up there from Graves County in Paducah, what's the first thing you do? Well, you take a tour of the city, of course. So here he is standing in front of his congressional office building. There he's standing in front of one of the monuments. And there he's standing in front of the White House. Wonder what was going through his mind. Now, as a young congressman, he got to meet many important figures around the nation and around the world. This gentleman here shaking hands in front of him with the hat is none other than Clarence Darrow, a great attorney. Now, Barclay took to being a public servant very well, and he worked very hard, and there's his loving wife in the back. That's a plane. That's a biplane, and they're getting ready to, it's a bomber, actually. They're getting ready to go over to Europe and do some investigative work for Congress, and so there they are. There he is with the president campaigning for the party. Now, anybody know who the gentleman in the middle is? This is another reason we need to teach Kentucky history here in Kentucky to our young people. This is another one of my favorite figures from times past. He's a Western Kentuckian, too. He's from Madisonville. He's got a great name. Ruby LaFoon. Ruby LaFoon from Madisonville, governor. Now, why do I have a picture of a wrecked car here? Well, like I said, Barclay took his job very seriously. And on one trip back home, he knew he had important business back in Washington. So he got into the family car and drove all night to get back to Washington to appear at a vote or a committee meeting. And on the way, I don't know if he fell asleep or what, but he had a wreck. How would history have been changed if he had been killed that evening? But being a public servant is not always a safe thing to do, as that picture depicts. Now, I had an opportunity to have lunch this past weekend with Albin and his wife, Pat, and we had a nice conversation. Carolyn was along. And Albin shared with me that his grandfather had a reputation for not being too good of a driver. And it seems like that out at Angles on the driveway going up, I don't know if it's still there, but there used to be kind of some bricks all the way up, you know, lining the driveway. And it curved a little bit. Now, you got to remember, the Veep learned how to drive on a horse, then a buggy. And these newfangled cars were a little cantankerous to him. And Albin shared with me that on more than one occasion, his famous grandfather would get in the car and head out that driveway and get a wheel caught over those bricks and get that car stuck and have to call for a wrecker to come out and pull him out. Now, as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Barclay established himself as a Wilson Democrat with strong party loyalties. Some would even call him a yellow dog Democrat, and I see a few in here tonight. Now, a few minutes ago, I shared with you all a story about how Barclay had to learn shorthand as a clerk while reading the law for these area attorneys, and that would play a role later on in his life. Well, here's what happened. As a freshman representative in Washington, he had an audience with President Wilson. And during the conversation, Barclay looked over and noticed that the president was taking notes in shorthand. And not just any shorthand, the same type of shorthand that Barclay had been trained to take. And he made an off-the-cuff comment about the president's note-taking. Well, Wilson was a very intellectual, very academic, and had high writing standards, and was very impressed by the fact that Barclay knew how to take shorthand, and they immediately extended their meeting to discuss the taking of shorthand, and they became fast friends through that serendipitous occasion. Wilson was a highly effective partisan campaigner, as well as legislative strategist. He was also a Presbyterian of deep religious faith. He appealed to a gospel of service and infused a profound sense of moralism into his idealistic internationalism, now referred to as Wilsonian. Young Barclay was an ardent supporter of Wilson and his programs, considered him a role model and mentor, and grew in political prominence in Washington in part as a result of their association, which again all began due to a mutual hobby of taking shorthand notes. As a member of the U.S. House and Senate, Barclay became widely known for his skill as an orator with a never-ending repertoire of anecdotes. Barclay's superior speaking ability, reasoning, and parliamentary skills helped him gain positions of leadership and also helped him gain support for many of the programs initiated by the presidents he served, Wilson and Roosevelt particularly. His speaking style was similar to that of another one of his heroes, William Jennings Bryan, with a booming voice and excited movements. Many of his stories reflected stories he had heard growing up and the people he had known here in Western Kentucky. One of the things I like about Barclay was he said, if a story is good, it bears repeating. It's just like a good song. It requires singing over and over. And he would use those stories to address many situations and diffuse many hot situations. Now, this picture here is a picture of Barclay campaigning. I believe that Secret Service there around him in the back. Now, this is in Paducah. You recognize the building at the end of the street here? That's the Coca-Cola Bottling Company. And if you read the banner above there, that says Senator Barclay, vote Democrat. I can't make out the other there, but that was a banner that hung across the road there. This is Barclay out at the Paducah Airport before we had the brick building that's out there now. I imagine they're getting ready to do a little traveling, and I'm sure he's doing some politicking there with the people around him. Now, I love this picture. I told you that Barclay used humor to make his points, and it looks like that constituent is really enjoying whatever story Barclay just told, and Barclay's having a pretty good hoot himself. He was a person of the people. Common man's friend. Now, I mentioned his speaking style, and I wanted to show you him in action. I don't know where this is, but he's got all the radio microphones in front of him. He's got his fist making a point there, but he still has a smile on his face. There he is again. I don't know what battle he's fighting, but he sure is flailing at them, isn't he? Now, here's a series taken at a campaign stump, and you can see the different gestures that he would use in making his points. Now, one thing that he was noted for was he always had a vest, and he always had his thumb in his vest. And you'll see it there. It keeps coming back to it. There you go. See that thumb there in his vest? Now, like I said, Barclay was known for his superior speaking ability, and it rivaled anyone in the land. His influence grew and grew, and he was featured on the front page of Time magazine at least twice. Now, how many more people from Western Kentucky from Kentucky, that for that matter, do we know who's been on Time magazine even once? We'll get to this in a minute. In regard to his speaking ability, there was a university poll that was taken earlier in the last century about who the greatest orator of the time was. And Barclay was named one of the top 10 orators of the last century. Isn't this a man we should remember today and tell our kids about? Like I said, he borrowed a lot of his stories, and if they were good, he repeated them. He could keep an audience's attention for well over an hour without tiring them out. His speaking ability was so keen that he was asked to deliver the keynote address at the 1932, 1936, and 1948 Democratic National Conventions. By the way, that poll was conducted at Wisconsin University. Now, when he took office as vice president at Truman's inauguration on January 20th, 1949, Barclay was the oldest person to have been sworn into that office, being 71 years of age. Barclay was the last president, or vice president, to be born in a log cabin. He was the last vice president to preside over the Senate. He was the first working vice president by virtue of his inclusion by Truman in all cabinet level meetings and his membership on the National Security Council. You see, Truman had been excluded from these high-level meetings by Roosevelt, and Truman resented it, and he felt ill-prepared when he was called on to step into Roosevelt's shoes when Roosevelt died. He wasn't going to allow that to happen with Barclay. Besides that, they were fast friends. Now also, Barclay was the only vice president to marry while in office. After his first wife died, he was remarried while serving as vice president. I think I have a few pictures of that. Now here he is at the Democratic Convention getting the nomination as vice president. There's Truman congratulating him. Now this is a little bit down the road when they won. Now you'll remember that they made a barnstorming trip across the country campaigning, and Barclay is credited a great deal with the victory because of his rousing speeches. A young person couldn't keep up with the schedule that he kept. And I'll throw this in too. He didn't just use trains. We've got some plane pilots in here with us. He was the first politician to use planes on a large scale across the country as he campaigned, and it paid off, and it looks like they're pretty happy. There they are coming back to Washington after the campaign, fast friends. Here they are, here's Barclay at one of the get-togethers at Sam Rayburn in the front. Sam Rayburn, you know, was the Speaker of the House. Well, did you know that they served together as freshman representatives, and they knew each other all the way through their service, and that is one reason why they got so many things passed. They could work together, he and Sam Rayburn. course, Barkley went on to be speaker and this in the our majority leader in the Senate. Now here's Truman with some of his cabinet, and you see Barkley taking a strong role. In fact, it's said that Barkley penned the initial drafts to a number of major legislations here at Ingalls while home resting. One of the grand achievements of that administration was a Social Security. Now, Truman thought Barkley was important enough to have his own seal. The president had a presidential seal, so he had Barkley develop a vice presidential seal, which is still used in a differing form today. But there's Barkley showing it to some international guests. He spoke, the president utilized him a great deal in speaking around the country. There he is with the military, a strong supporter of our military. There's another picture I don't have of him eating with the troops out by a campfire in Korea. Here he is meeting with the Pope, representing the U.S. with the Pope. Now, anybody know who that is?
May I add something?
Yes, absolutely.
Barkley was a senator, and he appointed my uncle to the Naval Academy.
Well, and who was your...
Uncle?
Admiral. I'd say that was a pretty good commission. I think Barkley was a good judge of character there. Now, does anyone know who this young man is with the... That is Charles de Gaulle. I could have included a number of people here, but I included that picture for my future mother-in-law. You see... before becoming an American citizen, was a pilot with the French Army and flew stunts and jumped out of a plane 5 times. So she, Donnie Watson right here, let's give her a hand as well. And just to be fair, my future father-in-law, Bill Watson, was the pilot for the Paxton Media Group for a number of years. Now, not all of his duties were happy duties. Following the World War II, he worked with the committee investigating war crimes, and he went to Buchwald over in Germany, Weimar. And this is a picture of him inspecting the carnage there before him. And let me see if I can find... wanted to read you something. Do you have that book? Would you turn it to me? Thanks to Pat Barkley, I came across a description of this scene that's depicted here. And I'd like to read to you what this historian, a Harvard historian, author, had to say. Take a look at this as I read this. In Buchenwald, April 24, 1945, Senator Alvin Barkley stands before a cordwood pile of corpses. To us today familiar with such images as Barkley in 1945 was not, what we see first is genre, the pit, which we easily turn into iconography, the Holocaust. But one must look at Barkley. The corpses are naked. He is heavily clothed in vest, suit, overcoat, hat, shoes. He stares at the corpses. The dignity in his face is bottomless. He is not dignified. The word immediately suggests pose, knowledge, distance, authority. This man, the photograph says, has struggled to understand what he has been made to look at, to understand something all of his experience of contemporary life and all of his reading of history have not prepared him to understand. And he has succeeded. The dignity in his face is not his own, and it is not that of the power he represents. In a moment of unpredictable comradeship and humility, Barkley has taken the dignity of which the people upon whom he gazes were robbed into his own face. If I were to die in this way, his face says, I would want someone to look upon me in this way. I think that pretty well captures his character. Thank you, Pat, for sharing that with me. I didn't want to leave tonight without reading that. I'm going to change this because that's a pretty gruesome view.
Shay, my father was in the forward group. He was a first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. The first captain. And whooping ball.
So he saw some of that carnage as well. Now, I said earlier that we have a better quality of life here in Paducah because of Barclay. And there he is speaking in front of the crowd gathered for the dedication of the Kentucky Dam, which he brought here to us through the TVA. Later, Barclay Dam was named for him. Now, I mentioned that he was married. This is Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington. This is the crowd gathered. Barclay was a big celebrity in his day. And this is the crowd gathered to watch him marry Jane. Now, during the interval, before he was remarried, his daughter, was it Sis? Was the one who went around with Barclay to accompany him on all his official visits. So she played an important role during that period as well.
Shay, that's where President Bill Clinton attended church when he was in the White House.
Bill Clinton attended there as well. There he is arriving for his wedding. Looks pretty happy. There he is waving at all of his people who've come out to wish him well. There he is with his bride-to-be. Now, I want to talk a little bit about his funeral because we're running out of time and we'll have to close. I invite anyone to stay around unless we've got a number of historians here tonight who I know can share more stories with you. There's a lot of humorous stories that I haven't had time to share with you tonight for wanting to go through these pictures. But let's hang around and have fellowship a little bit after the program tonight. But after he served as vice president, Barclay came home and he decided he wasn't through with public life, ran again for Senate, and beat John Sherman Cooper, went back to Washington. Didn't serve for long, though. Was elected, or took office in 55 and died in 56. He had gone to Washington and Lee University in Virginia to take part in a mock Democratic convention there. And as his voice rose, as he was making a point, he had a massive heart attack and fell over dead. I have the recording here for anyone who wants to hear it. But his last words were those famous words that we all should know. I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than to sit in the seats of the mighty. Well, he had sat in the seats of the mighty, but he knew whose kingdom he still served. And when I have to meet my Lord, I hope that I have similar words falling from my lips as our great vice president. As I said, I'm going to close tonight. Another phrase he gave was, give them hell, Harry, by the way, during one of the campaigns. So many great stories, too many to tell tonight. I want to thank Bobby Wrinkle and the McCracken County Public Library for having me here tonight. Be glad to come again and share some more. Thank each of you all for coming. Let's do what we can to preserve our heritage here in far western Kentucky. God bless you and good night.